In the third hour yesterday, we were talking about Messiah. We were also talking about Christos and Christus. And to bring everyone up to speed, placeholders were used in the Septuagint, and the strategy was continued in the original autographs and all of the pre-Constantine codexes of the eyewitness accounts in what is referred to errantly as the Christian New Testament. And so the basis of the religion known as Christianity and what has been come to be assumed as the last name of the individual misnamed Jesus is based upon a Greek word, Christos or Christoon or Christou, depending on how it's written in the text. That's actually not written in the text. And that's the amazing thing. You've got a religion and you've got an individual named after something that's not actually there. And we talked about the divine placeholders that permeate the Septuagint and the pre-Constantine manuscripts of the Greek eyewitness accounts. And they are universal. Placeholders were used for a number of reasons, the most important of which is you can't transliterate, which means to replicate the sound of Yahweh's or Yahusha's name using the Greek alphabet. Just can't be done. And so rather than mispronounce it, they use placeholders to tell you where to look to find the name. As it relates to the titles, Hebrew is an extraordinarily expressive language. It's the language that Yahweh chose to communicate in. Yahusha himself spoke Hebrew. And Hebrew is extraordinarily unique among languages. And therefore, to take important titles out of Hebrew and to try to translate them into a language that is deficient in these categories, as is Greek, and then into English, you lose too much along the way. Now, let's speak a little bit about Hebrew and what makes it unique as to why you ought not think that God communicated in English or in Greek. Hebrew is the only language that is eternal in time. In Hebrew, there is no past, present, or future tense. There is no verb stuck in time because Yahweh isn't stuck in time, and Yahweh is represented by his words. If you want to meet God, if you want him in your life, if you want to know who he is and what he's offering, read his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He is represented by those words. He is more real to you in those words than if he walked in the room on fire. And the only language that he can be that real, that consistent with his own nature, is Hebrew, which is eternal in time, not stuck in time. In addition, in Hebrew, almost every verb has a stem. And the stem denotes relationships. And the relationship might be between the subject and the object, or the subject and the verb, or the object and the verb, or between all three. And it tells you the relationship between the subject, the object, and the verb of the sentence. It's extremely important to understand these relationships. Hebrew is a relational language, which means there are statements in Hebrew where the subject, who might be God, is influencing literally and genuinely humankind, which might be the object of the sentence. And there's places where it's reversed, where we can do things that have an impact on God. There are things in Hebrew where the influence is direct, literal. There's places where the influence is passive. So the stems are an extremely unique aspect of Hebrew, and English and Greek don't have stems. You can't express the relationships, the cause and effect between subject, object, and verb in English or in Greek. Moving on, then you have the issue of the moods in Hebrew. A significant number of Hebrew words, verbs, come with a mood. For example, that section from Yashaya 8 that I was sharing, most of the verbs were scribed in the volitional mood. In the volitional mood, the subject or the object of the sentence is either expressing their desire or their will, or they are being encouraged to act based upon the auspices of free will. It's a choice. It's a decision. It's a desire that is being expressed. And so when you take Yah's message away from Hebrew and you leave all of the information that's made available that makes it richer, deeper, and more meaningful through the stems, through the moods, through the even the conjugations, which speak of either behaviors that are ongoing and unfolding over time in the imperfect, or one-time events, something that has happened, it's completed, and maybe not in the past, it might be something that's going to happen over a short period of time in the future. All of that said, that brings me to Richard, who is calling in from Washington. And Richard, is this the Richard who has produced and manages the Bless Yahweh website?
No, it's not. So
okay.
Somebody else.
Okay. All right. There's a Richard in Washington, either Washington or Idaho, one of the two, that has a marvelous website called Bless Yahweh, which has archives of not only of this show, but of all of the books that I've written and shared over the years. Okay. So, Richard in Washington, you had a comment on the Hebrew language and Christianity being a myth?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. The first five books of the Bible are definitely the mythology of the Hebrew, and that was a small band of desert people versus the whole world at that time. And each culture has produced its own religious mythology. That's what holds the culture together, and I totally agree with that, and I'm totally impressed with the language of Hebrew being utilized to bring coherence to their mythology. It's all tied up in sound, vibration. It's totally an amazing concept that they've created through the Hebrew language. But what I wanted to point out was something happened at the year zero that we never want to recognize, and that's the Caesar cult was changed into the Christianity that we now have today. It was a total transformation of Caesar as God into a biblical, quote-unquote, perspective that was the first psyop against the people for control. And that's the true shattering. The myth is all the religious we have.
Okay. All right, Richard, let me. You said a lot of things. I want to comment on them. Some of the things you've said are true. Some are partly true. Some are not true. And so let me go back to the beginning. Torah, the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, but the Torah in particular, which is the first five or six books of the Hebrew text, depending on whether or not you include the book of Yahusha in them, is not a book that was written by a community of desert dwellers. And the reason I know this to be the case is that I've done a systematic evaluation of Bereshith, virtually every word, of Kara, of Shemoth, excuse me, which is names changed to Exodus, and of Kara, which means to be called out, changed to Leviticus, as well as Devarim, which means words. And as I have systematically not only translated those books from the oldest extant material, which would be from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran, the text, what I have found is so profound, so accurate scientifically, so precise in terms of its message, so consistent with its message, so profound with its message, that the probability that it was articulated by someone other than God, I found to be less than one chance in 10 to the 100th power. It's God proves his authorship, particularly of the Torah, but also of the prophets. So I don't see, well, I see that the message of the Torah served a group of people who lived 40 years in the desert with Yahweh. It most certainly wasn't inspired by them. Moving on to and I'm going to put you on hold here for a moment, Richard, only because of the background noise that was just way too loud, and I'll take you off hold in a moment. As it relates to the Caesar cult in year zero, they're actually in there isn't a year zero in the Julian calendar. There's no year zero in either the Roman Catholic replacement for it. Ulius, as his name was, which means Harry, Caesar means Harry, but Ulius was his name, and Caesar, which means Harry, was the title that he bequeathed upon himself, did in fact claim to be a divine. And he did begin the transformation from Rome as a republic to imperial Rome. Rome was extraordinarily vicious, beastly, and evil. A terrible empire prior to Julius Caesar, Julius Caesar as he's known to us. And it was a horrible menace after it was transformed from republic to dictatorial empire. But Rome was not the first, nor anywhere close to the first, empire to promote the myth that its kings, its leaders, were divine. I mean, this began all the way back in first Babylon and continued through not only Babylon and Assyria and with the Persians and the Medes, but also permeated Egyptian political and religious culture. Really, throughout recorded history, the political leaders of countries have more times than not become also the religious leader of those empires. And there's been really no dichotomy, no difference between the politics, the governance, the military, and the religion of those societies. They all worked in harmony to control and fleece and corrupt, mislead individuals, and to empower the few over the many. So with those thoughts, Richard, I'm going to bring you back on to see if you have a comment on any of that, and then we have my good friend Larry back. Oh, that was my fault entirely. In fact, I have to apologize here. What I did here is that I mishandled the switchboard, thinking I was locking Richard N. and then bringing Larry N. And the way that I did it, I ended up disconnecting both of them. So as we have a commercial break, I hope they both call back in and that my mistake is corrected. You know, sometimes you get what you pay for in terms of hosts, and since I'm not paid anything to do this show, you may actually be getting nothing but butterfingers. Anyway, we'll return to this conversation with Richard and with Larry and the history of man's malfeasance when we return to Shattering Myths. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we bring Richard back, we have my good friend Larry, who's called back in. Larry, do you want to comment on Richard's statement?
I have a brief second here, and so I wanted to kind of lay this out. You know, back in, and it's dated, so I don't have to guess when it was. Zachary wrote a piece talking about a battle 19 years from now in our future.
Yes.
It's called the Battle of Magedon, which is now pronounced, are called Armageddon.
Yeah, Armageddon, which means the mountain of
Armageddon. But this is what, so he wrote this in 520 BCE. Now, there's only a small period of time, say in the last 100 years, that this could have even been possible. But since he's writing it about a period now, this is what he says. On this day, Yahweh declares prophetically, I will strike every fast-moving flying weapon of war and confuse the drivers, causing them to be irrational. Near the household of Judah, I will keep my eyes open judgmentally. I will strike every army and fast-moving flying weapon of war with disorientation and blindness. Now, he just said fast-flying weapons of war with drivers in them.
Right. Right, I know. Yeah.
What a guess, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there, you and I have
Qumran and scrolls, of course. Right, that's extant.
Yeah. You and I have talked about why we have chosen to trust Yahweh, and that he authored his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And amongst them is, for example, the revelation to Daniel in 555 BCE that that chronicles the demise of Babylon, which is where he was living in captivity. And by the
names, each successive empire.
Right, and precisely how they would conquer the previous one, including the Persians, the Median Persians over Babylon, and then how Alexander the Great would come along and conquer the Persians, and then how out of the Alexander the Great's empire there'd be four kingdoms, which is exactly what was established, and then how Rome would take over for them, and then how Rome would be the most vicious and beastly of all, and it provides great insights into the nature of Rome that you can then trace through history. It, even in that, in the ninth chapter, it provides a timeline from the declaration to return and restore Jerusalem to the exact day that Yahshua would walk into Jerusalem. As the Passover lamb, and it's precise to the day, 4 days before Passover in 33 CE, which happens to be 4,000 Yah. And recently we did a whole series of shows on the predictions of Yahshua, Isaiah 17 and 18, where Yah tells us that the last wars that mankind will fight will commence through this battle in Greater Syria, which would be Syria and Iraq.
And it says Damascus will be a twisted heap of ruins.
Correct, that the government of Damascus will ultimately fall, and that the terrorists who brought it down will go around the world and to try to keep them from perpetrating terror in every country around the world, that Israel's going to be sacrificed, narrowed at the waist, which means that UN 242 is going to be imposed on Israel. And that as a result of that, the Muslims by the millions are going to descend upon Israel in the Magog War. And you read what he has to say, and it's so profound, so accurate. Or you just go to the creation account itself, and you realize that 6 days from the perspective of the Creator at creation is exactly 15 billion years from our perspective looking back. And he
talks about relativity.
Correct. So yeah, we came to the conclusion that the only rational and informed conclusion is that the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms was inspired by someone who was not constrained in time, that had not only seen and witnessed our extreme past, but had also seen and witnessed our not-too-distant future and reported all of this to us.
Yeah. I would like to quickly point out in the second line of Bereshith, known as Genesis in the book named after the sun goddess Biblia.
Yeah.
He uses the term, it's Tahom, which at its base root means Big Bang.
Right.
So Yahweh, 3,500 years
pretty
ago.
Pretty funny.
Used the term Big Bang right away when he was talking about the making of the universe.
Yeah, he even talked about the transition of light energy to matter, and that's when time began, because prior to light coalescing into matter, time did not flow. Unfortunately, Richard, we ended up talking through this short segment, but we've got you on the line, and we'll bring you back right after the commercial. At the end of this current segment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're back with Richard. And before, Richard, you comment on all that, I would say, and I've studied Julius Caesar. He was a really disgusting human being. And I've studied Octavian, Augustus Caesar, who I like even less. And what I've come to conclude is that the worst Romans were actually Hadrian, I would say, would probably be my least favorite Roman of all time, followed by Constantine, who as a pagan, as a worshiper of Mithras, decided he could use Christianity to further his ambitions, and then Theodosius, which I would consider perhaps the among the worst Romans, who actually imposed Christianity, made it illegal not to be a Christian right around 400 CE. So I think we have a lot of commonality when it comes to appreciating the great harm that has been perpetrated by Rome and its legacy even today. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, and I would pick out those same principles.
Do you actually know? I mean, Theodosius. I mean, everybody knows Hadrian. Hadrian is the guy that was going to put remake Jerusalem and his temple as a shrine to himself, and that's what started the first Jewish war. So a lot of people know Hadrian pretty well, but not many people know of Theodosius, and he is probably the worst guy in the plot of all, because he actually imposed Christianity. He made it such that if you weren't a Christian in the Roman Empire, they would kill you.
Yeah, exactly. But my take is that the victors or survivors rewrite history, and history is nothing more than a reinterpretation of what actually happened. And I would recommend the book Francisco Calata's Jesus Was Caesar, and coupled with Joseph Atwell's.
I'm not going to go there. Let me tell you, I'm always appalled when someone uses the name Jesus, because there was no one named Jesus. The letter J wasn't even invented for English until the 17th century, and there's no correlation between Jesus and Yahusha, which was the individual's name. The Christian Jesus was modeled at the Nicene Council. And it was staged by Emperor Constantine to create a new religion based upon an individual that they modeled after Dionysus. So if you actually want to know the basis of the Christian Jesus Christ, who is a mythical individual, the actual person was Yahusha. The best analog for the Christian Jesus Christ is Dionysus. Not Julius Caesar. There's very, very, very little in common between Julius Caesar and the Christian Jesus Christ. But there's almost no difference between Dionysus.
Can I point out something?
Sure.
Well, what this book says is exactly kind of what you're saying, but it takes it a step further. It shows you, it documents exactly how this took place. And it started, as you pointed out, in the year one, when, quote-unquote, Caesar or Augustus took over for Julius, who was killed in I think it was 44 B.C.
He actually took over much before year one. He was probably in the range of 15th or 16th year of his reign, Octavian, who has been renamed Augustus by year one.
Exactly. What happened was there was a cult formed in the name of Julius Caesar because he was declared a god upon his death. And Augustus used that to solidify his empire and started a trend which perpetuated that cult.
Let me interrupt. That's partly true, not completely true. It is true that Julius Caesar, Julius was his actual name, was an absolute egotistical scumbag. He was equal parts egotistical military and ruthless military leader, as well as a conniving political leader. And Octavian came to power largely because Julius adopted him before his death, and he was afforded the Senate gave him some legions to, because there was constant bickering between various people who were taking claims of the throne. He did rely heavily in his claim, his rise to power, on his being a Julian, being associated with Julius Caesar. But the cult of Caesar was really a minor aspect of Roman history. And I just finished writing about a 200-page analysis of the history of Rome and its corruption, its influence even today. And what you find is that the cult of Julius Caesar really played no role in the creation of the mythical religion of Christianity. Much of it was should be laid to Paul's feet. Paul, the author of half the Christian New Testament, is the founder of the religion of Christianity. And Constantine, through the Nicene Council, established the religion based upon the model of Dionysus.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
I would really recommend that you do read this book by Francisco Carlotta. He's saying somewhat the same that you are, but what he's pointing out was the campaigns of Caesar, and I read those in my
yes.
Latin class back in
yeah.
the old days,
yeah.
Were retranslated to become the Christian doctrine.
I'm telling you, I've read Caesar's writings. And Caesar's writings aren't retranslated to become Christian doctrine. The guy that wrote that is selling you a bag of manure. Caesar's writing. Goodbye. You know, there are lots of people that write unbelievably stupid stuff. And I don't know how many of you have actually read Julius Caesar's writing. Probably very few. My guess is that maybe 1 in 1,000 people have actually read it, Caesar's writings, as opposed to reading someone's interpretation of Caesar's writing. Caesar was really an interesting writer. He wrote in third person. There is nothing in the Christian Bible, the New Testament, that is written in third person. He always spoke of himself in third person. And almost all of his writings are his egotistical perspective on the role that he played in the various battles that he fought. And the sad thing about much of them is not only are they grotesquely inappropriate, but Caesar, I mean, he's relishing death. He is and he's always willing to reconstruct history to serve his own personal aggrandizement and his development. Now, if you actually study what transpired to create Christianity, what you find is that Paul is its author. And there is no aspect of Paul's letters that are similar in style and content to Julius Caesar. I mean, nothing. And if you look at the book of Matanyah and Yaokanan, the two eyewitness accounts, they bear absolutely nothing in common with Julius Caesar. And so this is just poppycock. That doesn't change the fact that Rome played a huge role in the birth of Christianity. Gargantuan. And part of that role was the integration of the Roman integration of religion and politics influencing so much of the world, where the Roman emperors were considered gods, and the religion of Rome and the politics of Rome and the military of Rome, because the Roman emperors were almost always emperors because they controlled the legions. As a matter of fact, it was Rome's legions that chose virtually all of Rome's emperors. It wasn't the Senate. It wasn't so much hereditary. It was the legions. If you pleased the legions, if you controlled the legions, if you bribed the legions, then you were declared de facto leader. That is really what happened with Octavian and how he ended up replacing Julius Caesar. But the primary reason that Rome created the ability for the religion of Christianity, which is a myth, to get promoted is because Hadrian was so anti-Jew, anti-Torah, anti-Yahudah, anti-Jerusalem, anti-Yahweh. And he tried to impose himself as God on the Temple Mount. And statues of himself, renaming Jerusalem after himself, building temples to himself and to Jupiter there. And the Jews said, no, you're not. Even if we die keeping you from it, no, you're not. And that led to the great Jewish revolt. And ultimately, as a result of that revolt, and this will be the second Jewish revolt, I think I misspoke earlier, what Hadrian did is he banned any Hebrew text. Every copy of the Torah that could be found, he burned. anyone who is a Hebrew scholar, he killed. And he outlawed circumcision. He outlawed the Sabbath. He outlawed the celebration of any one of Yahweh's invitations to meet with him. He created an antagonism towards all things Hebrew, Yahweh, his Torah, that created the environment, the fertile ground for an anti-Semitic religion like Christianity to flourish. And then years later, when Constantine decided that he could use Christianity to aid and abet his political agenda, and although he never embraced the religion, used the religion, what you find is that the Nicene Council, Constantine was able to create the religion of Christianity based upon a caricature that resembled Dionysus in almost every aspect. And then Paul, in his letters, and he's author of half the Christian New Testament, Paul was a Gnostic. Paul was more influenced by Greek mythology and Greek psychology, Greek philosophy, than he was by that of the Romans. And so it's not a regurgitation of Julius Caesar's military conquest that inspired Paul, but Gnosticism and his hatred of the flesh, and therefore of the Torah and circumcision. We'll be back with Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Shattering Myths, Richard called back and had a list of books that he wanted me to consider, which I'm not going to bother with. But let me tell you why I'm not going to bother with them. I was asked to come to understand why Muslims not only flew planes into our buildings on 9/11 and to meet with Al-Qaeda and to understand their mindset, but to expose and condemn the religion that motivates such hostile, violent behavior. And when I wrote Prophet of Doom, I could have read any one of 1,000 books that people have written about Islam. I chose not to do that. What I chose to do is to read the 5 oldest Islamic sources. The History of Islam's Formation by Tabari, the book called the Sirah, which is the chronological account of Muhammad. It's called Sirah is the biography of Muhammad. The two topical collections of hadith that were compiled within 200 years of Muhammad's death, and the Quran. And since the Quran is a jumbled mess without context or chronology, I use the two oldest chronological sources, the Sirah and the Tariq, to order the Quran chronologically and set it into the context of Muhammad's life. I know what the books say. So to read somebody's interpretation of them would be an absolute waste of time. I've read Caesar's notes, his commentary on his battles. I don't need to read somebody's view of what Caesar had to say. I've read the source material. I view Caesar as one of the most despicable human beings who's ever lived. And I know a lot about the Christian New Testament. I have translated huge swaths of it from the oldest extant manuscripts into English. And I've studied the basis of Paul's writings and have written an entire book on exposing and condemning Paul. And I can tell you that there is no commonality between Julius Caesar's third-person writings of his conquests and the basis of the Christian New Testament. That doesn't mean that Rome didn't have an enormous influence over the creation of the mythical religion of Christianity. It did. And we've shared with you how that transpired. But the primary driving force in Paul's letters, which is half of the Christian New Testament, is Gnosticism. And Julius Caesar was not a Gnostic. And the eyewitness accounts talk about Yahusha in his historic setting as the literal manifestation of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Caesar knew nothing of those things. And there literally is no basis for the claim. So why would you read a book where some guy claims otherwise? I know the source material. I know it's not true. That doesn't mean that, again, that Julius Caesar didn't influence what Christianity became. He did, by being both God in general and political leader. He did. Was his name as in J.C. Julius Caesar influential? Well, you know, there was no J, and Caesar was not his his last name. But is there some tie-in to the creation of a name for Yahusha at the Nicene Council? Boy, that would be an extraordinary stretch. Beyond the initials, of which, by the way, there is no J in Greek, there is no J in Latin, so the English JC and the similarity to Julius Caesar did not exist in those languages. So even that is too big of a stretch to overlook throughout time. You know, so I'm just sorry. It's literally, it is impossible. And when you know something's impossible, just because somebody wrote a book on it doesn't mean that you have any interest in it. You know, just because you know that Rome influenced, created the environment in which the religion of Christianity could prosper, but so did Greece. So did, and Paul played the leading role. It's always dangerous, I think, to know some things but not all things. And I'm not going to claim to know all things. It's too many people take snippets out of context and ignore the overwhelming amount of evidence to the contrary and instead focus on a tidbit here and there. It's kind of like those that claim that the flood is based upon the Babylonian Gamildemith epic when they have 0.1% commonality and 99% dissimilarity.